Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Thank you for joining us in this, the latest edition of the OIS podcast series. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm Distinguished Research Fellow at the Institute. And I'm today joined by Michael Maiden, who's Director of the Gas and China Programmes, and Yang Qing, who is Research Associate at the OIS. And we're here to discuss the China sections from the forthcoming paper that is discussing the turmoil in the global energy markets following the Russia invasion of Ukraine, and also implications for Asia, as well as the recently published Oxford Energy Forum, The Evolution of Carbon Markets and Their Role in Climate Mitigation and Sustainable Development. Now, just to timestamp the recording in this ever-changing market, we are recording this podcast on the early afternoon of Thursday, the 4th of August, 2022. Mikhail and Jan, welcome back to the OIS podcast series. Well, look, Mikhail, can I start with you? Now, your forthcoming paper discusses some of the direct and indirect implications of the Russian invasion of Ukraine for Asian energy markets and policies. So can you tell our listeners, you know, why are you writing this paper at this time, and specifically perhaps, you know, one or two key points of interest for China?
So the paper has been work in progress for several months, actually. But really, it came from this recognition that, of course, we're talking about Europe and the implications of the Russian invasion of Ukraine and various sanctions. Of course, it is at the forefront of events. But really, since energy markets are global, the ripple effects of Western sanctions on Russia, and be they on coal, gas or oil, are felt worldwide. Even in countries that may perhaps not have the most open economies in Asia, the impact is felt. And so it's really important to consider, I would call it, some of the unintended consequences of those sanctions. Now, the paper really discusses China and India in most depth, but it also talks about other Asian energy consumers. I think a few things are rather striking. And before we turn to China, the usual caveats, of course, the direct exposure to Russia varies widely by country. Obviously, development levels are widely different across Asia. So really taking Asia altogether is complicated. Asia is very much exposed to Russian coal, to coal in general, because it is a big part of the energy mix. And a number of countries, mainly China and Japan, rely on Russian gas. And now India, as well as China, rely more on Russian oil. And of course, you've had a podcast as well on Indian oil and Russian flows. But so there's perhaps a perception that Asian countries are picking up lots of discounted Russian flows. Some are, but the story doesn't end there. And of course, it's much more complicated than that. So, of course, we wanted to unpack that. China, as you will have heard, sort of figures in all those categories: coal, gas, oil. And even though China has been buying discounted and perhaps distressed cargoes, the trade-off is complicated with the regional environment, again, that has become much more complex. If we look at coal, for instance, more non-Russian coal is going to Europe. But then Indonesia and Australia, some of the big coal producers, are feeling the pressure. They're raising prices. And at the same time, countries such as Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka are facing energy poverty. They're grappling with the affordability of energy and food costs. Political turmoil in Sri Lanka is one example. But of course, that makes China's kind of near abroad very complicated in a year where China needs a lot of stability. It's already facing a number of domestic issues. And all that to say that in this context, the issue of energy security is front and center for a number of countries, but for China as well.
Okay, so on this kind of issue of energy security then, in China, is that effectively equated with coal then?
I think the easy answer is yes, and that it would seem very much to be the case. Certainly this year, with coal production increasing quite dramatically in coal use and power generation, new coal-fired power plants being approved. It didn't just start this year, though, and we've talked about this in different podcasts as well, and we've written about this. The power outages that China suffered last year also put a spotlight on coal and how basically coal is sort of the backbone of the Chinese energy system, and we've discussed elsewhere how it's also the backbone of China's political economy in many ways. So the kind of coal comeback has been on the cards and on the table, not just this year, and you can trace it back to 2019, but of course this year with all the turmoil, we're really seeing coal pick up, and we're seeing the discussion and the narrative in China about the importance of coal, about its reliability, But at the same time, there's been an interesting development, I think, in the energy security debate in China, where with the world looking like an increasingly hostile place for China, with growing tensions with the West, and again, 4th of August, we're just the day after Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan, and we've got military drills around Taiwan today. All of that is leading China to think more and more about self-sufficiency. And actually, energy security is increasingly being equated with renewables. So I think, again, the easy answer is to say China's turning back to coal. But the reality is more complicated. Decarbonization may have taken a slight backseat this year. But when you look at some of the longer-term plans, some of the market reforms and progress, they do give cause for a bit of optimism that carbon neutrality and the energy transition are still on the cards, at least for the longer term.
Okay, Jan, well, can I come to you now and pick up on that? Because a very clear message there on the role of coal from Mikhail. Now, China's national carbon market was launched and started trading last July. You know, so in your view, how has this National Emissions Trading Scheme, ETS, performed in its first year of operation? Do you think its performance is actually meeting expectations?
Yeah, indeed. So last July, China's national carbon market finally launched after really a decade of preparation. Well, this nationwide market covers the power generation sector. That is basically almost all of the coal and also gas-fired power plants in China. And yearly emissions are almost 4.5 gigatons. So it is really the largest ETS, emissions trading system, globally in terms of covered emissions. And as you said, it is targeting at coal first and foremost. Well, regarding the performance of the ETS, I would say it is in line with expectations, but of course, depending on who you ask. But I think at least now the China ETS is up and running, and the power companies, especially coal power producers, they start to get an idea of carbon trading, and they are more aware of carbon costs. So I think this is a big improvement. And official data from the Environment Ministry shows that the compliance rate has been 99.5% by end of 2021. And this just really means most of the covered entities, most of the covered power companies really fulfilled their obligations. Well, commenting on trading, well, in the past year, the price of China carbon allowances has went up from 50 Chinese yuan to 60 yuan this year. 8 to 9 euros. This is not very high. But having said that, trading volumes, etc., has been have been improving. But although it's been on the periodical pattern, we observe that daily trading volumes are mostly around 100k ton. And there has been a surge in trading volumes last December, just ahead of the compliance deadline. But then the market turned rather quiet. This is because participants, they are really waiting for further clarity in the ETS policy framework. And in recent months, there are a few occasions where daily trading volumes has plummeted to as low as 10 ton. So this is really tiny. And this sort of dented liquidity might still continue for a while.
It is quite fascinating, you know, whenever we talk about China, the three of us, you know, about, you know, when you say it's the largest carbon trading scheme, it just shows the size of the country and the implications it has when they actually apply. And so some of the compliance rates you're talking about are incredibly high. But let me just stay with you, Jan, if I can, for a minute. You know, so what is the next for the China National ETS? You know, what role do you think it can play in helping China to achieve the carbon neutrality goal?
Yes, yes. I mean, the system is definitely will evolve further. And as we have mentioned and discussed in the Oxford Energy Forum as well, I mean, it's already been a long process to set up this national ETS, and it will certainly take more time to develop further. As also mentioned, the price of allowances is quite low, and this is really just 8 to 9 euro, a fraction of the price in more matured carbon market, such as the 80 euro level in the EU ETS. I think the low price in China ETS is partly due to quite generous allocation at the start. The most of the, let's say, most of the coal power plants, they really got sufficient free allowances to cover their needs. Well, yes, but the authority has also stated that the ETS is an important tool to achieve China's climate goals, and the mechanism will be reformed further. This means the benchmarks will be tighter, and the ETS will also expand to more industry sectors in the coming years. And the current intensity-based target in the ETS may also be transformed to an absolute cap, so meaning an absolute emissions target, and as in other ETS. But this may not happen in the very near future, perhaps later this decade, as China will peak its emissions before 2030. Well, to summarize, I think the significance of China's ETS is that, first of all, this ETS has established a national carbon price in China. So businesses and even individuals, they now have a reference price they can use for their carbon costs. And second, the construction of the ETS has established and will also further strengthen the carbon data accounting and monitoring system. And I think this is really essential for China to achieve its carbon goals.
Okay, Yang, so in the coming months, you know, what are the kind of key events that our listeners should watch out for in the China carbon market?
Yeah, I mean, zooming in the next months, I think, or for the rest of this year, there are really several key events. I mean, to name two of them. So the first one is the ETS regulation, which may be published soon. And this new regulation will be a State Council level regulation, and it will replace the current interim rules for the ETS, meaning that this new regulation will really strengthen the executive power of the ETS policies. I mean, it can include much higher penalties for non-compliance, etc. So I think this is quite important. And second, I think what will come out very soon is the new allocation plan for the second compliance period. So the second compliance period will cover the 2021 and the 2022 emissions of probably also over 2,000 power enterprises. And this plan will contain the benchmarks, and it also expects to reduce these benchmarks for coal plants by, I think, at least 8%, as discussed in the draft versions. So yet, this new allocation plan will definitely tighten the allowance supply and make the ETS more effective in driving emissions cuts. And apart from these two, the ETS will also move forward to expand to more industry sectors. The wider expectations that cement and aluminium sectors could be the two that the ETS can roll out already in next year. And also the relaunch of a domestic offset market called CCER. This is also expected to happen later this year or early next year. Yet, so a lot to expect and keeping we analysts very busy.
Absolutely. As you said, a lot to watch. And as I said earlier on, whatever happens in China is very big, and so they'll have a lot of implications. But can I perhaps kind of turn the discussion for a minute, Yan, staying with you, back to kind of the China's climate policy, specifically related to the Russia-Ukraine crisis. So, you know, what are any impacts of that on the ETS?
Yeah, I mean, I fully agree. There's no country lives in vacuum in this world. And as Michal already discussed a lot in opening remarks, the ongoing crisis and especially elevated energy prices are impacting China too. But in terms of climate policy specifically, I agree with what Michal has mentioned too. The positive sign is that the leadership really has emphasized again the carbon neutrality goals a few times already in recent months. And also lately, the state planner and the ministries, they've released several new policy documents, I mean, including further boosting renewables, energy storage, and further green and low carbon transformation of industry sectors, etc. I mean, this shows the energy crunch really makes policymakers in China more aware of the urgency and benefits to transit away from fossil fuels and speed up the energy transition. Nonetheless, energy security has been dominating China's policy agenda already after last autumn's power shortages, as we discussed in the Oxford Energy Forum as well. So the current energy crunch is strengthening this trend in China, and also, China is turning more to coal. And Chinese regulators has approved more domestic coal production capacity and other measures to tackling the rising fuel prices and definitely ensure energy supply. Since the ETS covers coal and gas plants and their profitability really have been affected quite a lot due to the crisis and more costly fuels, there could be more headwinds from the thermal producers to tighter benchmarks in the ETS or to more aggressive reduction target of the ETS. Overall, there is always this discussion of balancing emission reduction costs and also the burden on the industry and end users. China National ETS has seen a rather soft start, as I discussed earlier. So the pace hasn't been that aggressive either. So overall, I think the impacts on the ETS is rather small.
Okay, well, Mikhail, why don't I come back to you then and kind of talk kind of more broadly about the kind of Asia and China energy transition. Kind of given the rising gas prices and the expected tightness in the energy markets kind of for several years to come, how do you see the role of gas in the energy transition in, say, China and in Asia?
Obviously, that's the million-dollar question, and we ask that about Europe as well. The first and easy answer, I think, is to say that it is too soon to tell, really, even though sort of everything that Jan and I have just said, that I think we're cautiously optimistic that the energy transition, at least in planners' minds, is still a priority. Practically speaking, decision makers, not just in China and Asia, but also in Europe, are preoccupied with the day-to-day managing of the latest crisis, sort of energy and economic policy related crisis. So it is hard, I think, to have a good sense of what is happening, and we need the dust to settle a little bit. Having said that, when we look at the role of gas, I think it's slightly different for China and sort of other Asian, emerging Asian economies. For China, gas still has an important role to play in the energy transition. It is, right, the biggest consumers of gas in China are industrial and commercial, the commercial sectors. Those will remain the key drivers of gas demand, even as gas demand growth slows in these sectors. Power sector is sort of the next area of big growth. And you talked about size, right? It's in the context of China, it's will the gas market grow by roughly 200 or roughly 300 BCM through 2030? That's kind of the scale of it. Of course, that matters greatly to global markets, but that is kind of the scale. And even at the upper end of that, we get to gas accounting for 15% of China's energy mix as the best case scenario, I would say. But if we turn back to the power sector, and Jan wrote a fantastic paper about this last year that is published and available on our website, I think there is a concern that the room for gas in the power sector could be squeezed now. It's today 6% of installed capacity, and we're looking at slightly over 100 gigawatts versus over 1,000 gigawatts for installed coal capacity. So it will grow for sort of flex capacity, but there's actually more discussion about coal plants being used for flexibility, which again could squeeze the role of gas. And renewables, as we mentioned earlier, if they're developed faster and if there's more storage, again, could squeeze the share of gas in the power sector. Now, there's lots of ifs in there. But all of those do point to an uncertain trajectory for gas and power. And when you add all these sectors, right, if industrial demand growth, kind of the coal to gas switching in industrial use slows, if power demand for gas growth slows, then again, we're leaning towards closer to 200 BCM rather than 300 BCM. But of course, again, it's still a very positive outlook. We often discuss the question of price, and obviously high LNG prices are impacting. But I think it is important to keep in mind that not all gas in China is very expensive, at least when we compare it to current spot LNG prices, right? Spot is maybe a quarter of total imports. And many of the contracts are still oil indexed. China has domestic supplies. It also has pipeline gas that is also oil indexed. So prices matter, but they matter at the margins. And I think if this winter it's very cold or China needs a lot of gas, China will buy spot LNG if it needs it, even if the prices are high. The other thing to bear in mind about China's kind of future gas demand, I think, is geopolitics, of course. When we think about greater gas demand growth, there's only so much that will come from domestic production. So does China rely on global markets for LNG? Does it turn to Russia for more pipeline gas? I mean, the reality of future demand outlook is that it needs both, but it's not a pretty picture, geopolitically speaking. And that does differ from Asia, and I won't go too much into Asia, but for a number of emerging countries, sort of Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, they're at the point of building the infrastructure for more gas and more LNG. So prices matter greatly now because the affordability is a huge challenge, and it places in doubt the role and the extent to which gas will play in their energy transitions. For China, it's there, it's done, it will increase. For other countries, I think we are at a slightly different moment in the development of their gas markets. Now, of course, you could flip that argument, and as our colleague Mike Fullwood says, in sort of post-2025 and towards 2028, LNG markets loosen with more projects coming up. We might go full circle back and have greater availability of LNG to support the energy transition in a number of other Asian countries. I think all that long story is to say that the dust needs to settle. For China, we're looking at potentially a slightly slower gas demand growth outlook for the next decade or so, but still a growing role for gas in the energy mix.
And one thing we do know, of course, is that the gas and the LNG industry has got a history of being very cyclical in nature. And so there will be some cycle at some point. So Mikhail, perhaps can I stay with you for the last question, which I'd like to kind of maybe talk about shifts in energy flows, because policymakers, of course, are very preoccupied with dealing with short-term issues. So I wonder, you know, what are the longer-term implications and how could that impact on energy flows in China and Asia?
I think the one thing to bear in mind is that, of course, there's a big upheaval and shifts in trade flows, as you mentioned. The Russian invasion of Ukraine, or at least sort of the turmoil in the aftermath of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, is heightening and accelerating trends, but it has not been, thus far at least, a game changer in, you know, upending everything that has happened. So context matters, and where countries have been matters greatly. Right. In India, we've seen more demand for everything. And that's been in large part because of a heat wave and, you know, greater economic activity. In China, we've actually seen suppressed demand for gas, for oil, slightly for coal. But that's been because of, again, the macroeconomic environment and the zero COVID policy. So, again, the broader economic outlook. Markets do what markets do when they sort of adapt to, and they optimize flows, right? With discounted coal, some of it is going to China, some of it is going to Korea, despite pledges to start moving away from Russian coal. LNG can't move very far because it's all being drawn to Europe, but oil is going to Asian countries, a lot to India and a lot to Russia, where they're buying discounted Russian barrels. Again, that doesn't change the sort of fundamental shape of things to come, I would say. And that's where I think we need the dust to settle a little bit more, because these questions about the energy transition are still open. I think the one thing that we do know is with the higher costs of energy and food, we are potentially looking at weaker economic growth in all of these emerging Asian countries. And that inevitably leads to weaker energy demand growth. That's potentially not bad for the energy transition if that leads to reduced emissions. But of course, when we're thinking, but if it comes to a point of energy poverty, and that's, of course, not a great outcome from the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Not all countries in Asia are equally exposed, right? We have Japan, Korea, Singapore that can still afford even higher prices. But again, the emerging countries that are potentially thrown into sort of broader political disarray from these events, and again, from rising costs. So even as China sits and looks at this and maybe has more discounted Russian cargoes of oil, gas, or coal, again, the outlook is extremely complicated. And hopefully, One of the lessons, but it is still not a foregone conclusion, but hopefully one of the lessons is that we have to pursue the energy transition, but policies need to be in place in order to enable that. We're still not seeing them firmly there, but again, hopefully we're going to end this with an optimistic note to suggest that maybe they will come and maybe that is the kind of only solution that comes from this.
Yeah, a lot of challenges, a lot of things happening in the world. As you say, we're recording this on the day after Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. So let's have a bit of optimism at the end of this podcast. Look, Mikael and Ian, thank you so much for your time today. As always, you know, I really enjoyed our conversation. And that builds on the messages from the forthcoming paper, Asian Energy Markets Following the Russia Invasion of Ukraine, that should be published soon by the OIS, and the articles in the June 2022 Oxford Energy Forum, which is available on the OIS website. So I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.